There was a marvelous sermon preached in Seattle not too long ago, and it was stated very well. It said, finally, the crisis in community finds its ultimate dilemma in the collapse of all unifying visions and myths around which we shape our lives. The absolute truths by which we have focused our lives are rapidly disappearing. We live in a scientific technological age, an age of ultimate relativities. And then this preacher goes ahead to say, the question of the gods of religion is the first sign that a culture is in transition. We live in a time of the fractured vision of what is essential reality. Rather than a shared vision, a shared community vision, each person in contemporary society, even in religion itself, is developing their own values and personal meanings. People in modern society are like customers standing in a supermarket. They select their values and personal meanings by personal choices according to various social roles and life involvements. They put them together into a privatized individual belief system which provides shaky support for life because it is not tied to any institutional base. Now, for those of you who are for the first time, that also gives you a quick update of what we've been talking about, which is the individualism and the privatization of American society, and especially as it affects also our community and our religion. And one more comment, and then I'll be ready for your answers. John Gardner of Common Cause, this some number of years ago, has written rather prophetically, we need more than individual value systems, we need a shared vision. A nation is held together by shared values, shared beliefs, shared attitudes. That is what enables a people to maintain a cohesive society despite the tensions of daily life. That is what gives a nation its tone, its fiber, its integrity, its moral style, and its capacity to endure. Now, one thing which is for sure, and in this class for previous sessions, we delineated the way there is a decline and collapse of community, and the decline in any kind of vision in America that unites us as a people. And I spent 37 years of my life in the church ecumenically trying to see if we do have a vision that unites us in the Christian church. And on my good days, I feel we have, and on my bad days, I feel we've got a long way to go. So my point is, and this is a very simple question, is it possible for us to have a common vision for our United States? That's the first question. Is it possible to have a common vision that unites us all? The black community, Asian community, gay community, women, men, people who are in Washington, D.C., and people who live in Seattle, all these kinds of different perspectives, sectional different points of view. Is there something that we have that can, or we need to create or realize, that will be something that can draw us together? It's obvious at the present time, if you read the letters to the editor, that we are greatly divided.
I have a question. It seems as though our Pledge of Allegiance, as far as a nation, seemed to instill some common vision, whether it was myth or not. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Wouldn't that be the common vision? But that's not allowed in schools anymore. Children don't have to. They don't do it in the morning. They don't
have to. There's a different opinion about
that. That was a result of a common cause, I think.
I, I, no,
not that, Common Cause.
No.
No, it was, I know, I don't know who started the Pledge of Allegiance. But does it, you're not, yes, go ahead.
It seems to me the only time a country's united is when it's at war. Then everybody comes together to fight to win the war.
Only one conversation at a time. Okay, go ahead.
I said, I thought the only time the country seems to be united is when it's at war. Then everybody works together to win the war.
Right.
And I don't know how it's united otherwise, and it's certainly not worth going to war to unite.
Well, you know, I sometimes have suspicions that presidents get us into wars because it does. They feel it does unite us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I sometimes, why we're getting so warlike over in Iraq, you see? I mean, it could be resolved otherwise. But people, I mean, I'm just overwhelmed the way that the media, the newspapers, everybody is glorifying, interviewing soldiers at Fort Lewis. They're getting on a plane, you know, all that stuff. I mean, they get really excited about it because it is. We have an enemy now. We have Saddam. It is true that we have been able to unite around wars. But that certainly is not a vision that's going to sustain us, I don't think. Yes?
I don't think there's been that unity. I think there was that unity in World War II, but it got less. Well, of course, Korea wasn't even a war. We haven't had a war since Korea.
Yeah.
Our boys have gotten killed, but it hasn't been a war. But I think World War II, they were united. Korea were the children of the World War II people. And even a lot of the World War II people felt, I don't want my son going to war. We fought the war to end all wars. Well, and the other thing I think is World War II had an economic result. Now we are so economically in the hole that it will make things worse, along with the other things that go with war. But to unite us, it has to have the economic feature too, I think.
Actually, a really scary thing I found, I was actually probably in eighth grade, but a teacher showed me this book, an encyclopedia. If you look at the economic position of our country, as far as, you know, in the hole and all that, versus, you know, a timeline, the only thing that's ever gotten us out of an economic hole has been a war.
World War II. That's what I said. World War II, yes.
World War I.
And behind that. But we've been living in a false economy ever since World War II. And you can only live in a false economy so long before it's going to go kaput.
No, but just history is kind of showing the best way to get out of a depression is to have a war.
Yeah, but I won't do it this time.
I think an answer to my question is not an answer. Would you agree?
Right.
It's not an answer. So the question's still there. What are the elements of a common vision that we have that unite us? And not just on the books, but in the minds of the people. In the minds of the people.
A specific issue, I wouldn't have any idea. But it would have to be, in my estimation, some issue that would divide it into two camps. And as soon as you get a community divided into two camps, you get a strong, interested community. If you have a community in one camp, then they'll start watching TV.
Say that again. Did you get people? Oh, just one camp?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, well, you're saying that part of the vision...
I don't know what the issue would be, but it would have to be something that would be strong enough to divide us into two camps. Hmm. Then we would become strong as one body in this one issue in two camps.
Mm-hmm. Is that really a good idea? Is that a positive way to look at the issue?
That's not a shared vision.
No. Well, I guess the question you have to ask is, a more fundamental question, is a shared vision possible? If not a shared vision, then what?
Well, the shared vision to get into these wars has always been freedom. We're the free, we're the democratic, the free countries. We're fighting for freedom, whatever that means. The waving of the flags, we're headed off on the ships and the planes.
But even with freedom, we don't have a great deal of agreement on that. Some people thinks it means the free enterprise system around the world, right? Other means thinks it means a political democracy.
Maybe what we need is to split up into the abortion rights group, pro and con.
Right.
Common cause.
Right. Well, I think you had the beginning of an idea there, and that is maybe the thing that really unites us is the vision of the possibility that we can sit down together and talk about our country, about its problems, and that we are truly a nation of people. Now, the only problem with that, however, is that most people feel powerless and impotent. And as we talked about earlier in this class, the urbanization of our society has segregated us into little groups, and the community is not what it was. Certainly, we don't have the town hall, the town meeting kind of thing much anymore. So some people maybe feel empowered by being a part of the process in the community, working on a problem. But even that, is that adequate? Ross.
Bill, look back at the bicentennial. We wrestled with how to celebrate it, and they came back and said, let each community celebrate its little history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a diagnosis of whether there is a common vision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do we celebrate an anniversary? And I don't know what people think about whether it was a success or a failure.
Mm-hmm.
They had a slam-bang fireworks on TV out of New York Harbor,
right,
and some other things. But was that a healthy country celebrating?
Well, that was, you have patriotism. Now, we have a lot of patriotism. But is patriotism, I have seen it, blind patriotism. I mean, I'm patriotic. I hang up my flag over 4th of July. But, yes?
I think World War I, we had more patriotism than I've ever seen since then. There was more unity than I've ever seen in our country before. World War I, that's when we had patriotism, we had unity.
But is that the vision we want?
Yeah.
I mean, we've done a lot of things in the name of patriotism that I don't like to think about.
But there was a kind of a nice
feel. There's a
slogan.
Nice feel.
There was a nice slogan.
Oh, a nice feel.
War to end war.
Yeah.
You know, freedom. We were the.
Yeah, my mother used to sing the first World War songs, you know, over there, mm-hmm. all that. I felt really good about it until I found out what was going on in the political realm all at the time this was happening, right? That we were being led down the alley by some blind leadership in Germany and wherever we were, England.
We got another dichotomy here. One that is affluence, gross affluence, and gross poverty. And where are you going to split that so you can get a good argument going both ways?
Yeah, right. Well, I actually back in 1980, just as Reagan was coming into his administration, the National Council of Churches produced a jewel. I don't know who did it or how they did it, but they had a little paper that talked about the two visions of America. One was a vision of our Puritan forefathers and our Constitution, a vision of equality, of a new kind of a New Jerusalem, now that kind of New Jerusalem kind of idea, that there was a more fair, just world ahead, and we should take care of the hungry and so on and so on and so on. That was one vision of America. The other vision was the vision of the exploitation. Vision of exploitation. And a couple of years ago, the state of Washington had its centennial, 100 years of statehood. And it was interesting to, as you read, we authorized a official history from the church's perspective of that. It was interesting to see that two kinds of people came to the state of Washington. One were the fur traders, the people who were interested in the forest, those who were interested in all the resources to exploit them, and the warehouses and the hill, so on. There was one group of people. And then there were some people who came, and their idea was to come to civilize the place, to civilize it and to save it. And they were, and they built the colleges. They built the hospitals. They built all the institutions of nurture, and that was their vision of America. America that took care of the people. The only problem is they had no sympathy or empathy for the Native Americans. In fact, the wife of the minister, the first Methodist minister in Seattle, her name was Blaine, Catherine Blaine, a great letter writer. Remember this, a great letter writer. And she wrote a letter back to New York State when she came, and she said of the squaws, the Indian squaws, she said, they're just like pigs in human form. Now that wasn't much empathy. As a Methodist, I'm not happy to read that.
It's history. How many Methodists wanted to buy the book?
But at least we had a vision, right? We had a vision for the Northwest, which was different than the exploitive vision.
It'd be difficult to get a sharp demarcation, because there's enough just across the line that are providing for the ones that are down on the ladder, that are dependent upon this central group for a livelihood, and it'd be difficult to get a breakout of separating into two groups like you do with, and I keep coming back to this abortion because it is so sharp.
Abortion is a very difficult issue. It is for people.
I'm wondering.
The specific that I'm thinking of here on the West Coast would be what Al over there has been trying to tell us, our ecological structure. We have the Earth First people, and then we have those who are natural resource reapers, and we've got two camps now, and we're getting a community on the West Coast because of this issue.
Right. So there are visions, and important visions that people have, right? But that is not one vision, but maybe we can only have a group of visions, you see.
I'm thinking in a democracy, it's almost impossible to have one vision, because there's so many different points of view on everything,
right.
And we're all allowed to express them. So I think I'm wondering if we won't have several visions.
Well, isn't our vision, even though it may be, isn't it contained in our national vision contained in our Constitution? And that Constitution's vision may change with time.
Yeah.
By process.
Yeah.
The process. But that's
liberty and justice for all?
Well, you said it may be a myth.
Yeah, but when they wrote that, they were thinking liberty and justice for white males. I mean, really, they were. That's what they're thinking about. Yeah, that is a myth. Yeah, well, myths, nothing wrong with myths. They're good myths or bad myths. They're fresh myths and they're old, tired myths.
Visions can be unrealizable.
Right. Well, without vision, what's her name?
Elise Boulding.
Elise Boulding came to Seattle a few years ago, and she said that the future is like we envision it. And she said that she had been doing a little study on the side. And she was asking, maybe I wrote that down somewhere, so I got it right. She, let me see, she said that, she said that she was asking people what they thought about the future. Was the future going to be better? And they responded, "We hope it isn't any worse. We hope it. We hope it isn't any worse than it is now, or something like that." In other words, they weren't thinking about a brighter, newer future, but they were hoping that things wouldn't get any worse. And so, I think that's part of our problem. We have visions. Do each one of you have a real strong vision for how you want society to be? Are you a part of a community that shares that vision pretty closely with you? And what is that vision? Do we have it in the church? Yes?
I think the real idea of community starts with the family, and I've been concerned about the breakdown of the family, and it takes a crisis in a family, really, to unite a large family.
Yeah. That's true.
But you've got division, you know, in the family, but you still have to have a commonality.
Right.
Society moves families to where jobs are available now.
Right.
That, I don't think that was traditionally always. I mean, obviously the people who came over from England said bye. But it'll take and split an entire family all over the nation.
The contemporary world does not make it easy on families, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
And that part of the mobility you're talking about, part of the fact is that young families feel that they have to have two breadwinners, or many families have only one parent. And daycare is not in great abundance. I was very unhappy with the president. He vetoed the Congress bill that would allow for time for parents to go home to their children. That was, I don't know what he's thinking about, for a man who said he's for family, right? But anyway, families are the first community, the basic community, and our society is not very helpful.
I think myself that we don't share enough in families, and that's why families aren't strong, and perhaps that's one of the weaknesses of communities, mm-hmm. is that we don't share our concerns or our love or God's love.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't share God's love.
Mm-hmm.
That covers a lot.
Right.
Well, the question is, can we all have a common feeling or idea? Is that it? No.
Well, at least something that, so we can say, yes, we are one people, we are people of the United States, and we hold these things as important.
Even though the Constitution is interpreted in many different ways, if one person were looking to interpret the Constitution one way, another person another way, even the Supreme Court can't agree on it. The five say one way, four say another. That doesn't mean that the five are right and the four are wrong. They just disagree. They didn't have a common feeling either.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that Reagan can be criticized for, but it seems to me, it just occurred to me that he did stir a common vision. It was the one thing he was able to do, I think, majority of the American people, was pull to a common vision of what America might be, and should, or something,
right.
In his vision.
Right. Well, I think what we're really demonstrating, and we're quite a united group. I mean, we're all mainly Methodists and Lutherans. And I understand, I just was reading this book today on American Mainline Religion, that we are in the same group. We're called moderate Protestants. We're not liberal Protestants, we're moderate Protestants, right? And we're basically middle class. So we share a lot. But in this book, and it's really an excellent book, called by Wade Clark Roof and William McKinley, called American Mainline Religion, and it's just written a couple of years ago. And the sociologist of religion, and he is saying that, he's talking about American religious individualism, which is a part of all our religious individualism of a nation, and the privatization of our values. And he quotes here Geraldine Ferraro. And Geraldine Ferraro said, the president, this was Ronald Reagan, walks around calling himself a good Christian. But I don't for one minute believe it, because his politics are so terribly unfair. They're discriminatory and they hurt a lot of people. The question was, who is a good Christian? See? And she's saying he's not a good Christian. And President Reagan said, so the minute I heard that she'd made that statement, I turned the other cheek. Oh. Pretty clever. Of course, the ridiculousness of that whole thing is that Geraldine Ferraro was a good Catholic, except she's like a lot of other American Catholics. They don't take the position of the church on the abortion issue being at issue here. She doesn't take the abortion issue too seriously. I mean, she thinks she has a right of choice, and that's important for her. It's more important for her to have that belief than to listen to the position of the Catholic Church. And of course, as you know, she was dealt with rather strongly by the Archbishop, the Cardinal of New York. Whereas, on the other hand, Ronald Reagan hardly ever went to church, right? But he was able to articulate the free enterprise, traditional values, and morality that most people responded to, right? So where are we? Not very far. A lot of us, and the whole evangelical, and the born again, the new religious right, their whole response was to return to a vision of America that was past, right? And we've been trying to, some of us hopefully, been trying to look to a vision of America is in the future. And so we have a lot of competing visions out there, all over the place. There's a couple more here that I thought were interesting. I want to share my reading with you. This item is modern Baptists. In James Wilcox's novel Modern Baptists, there is a provocative scene in which Bobby Pickens and his girlfriend Burma LaSteele reflect upon their religious identities. Burma's concern about Bobby's drinking turns, as a Methodist, I have been concerned about Baptists and drinking, that Bobby's drinking turns into an existential confrontation with life. Bobby, she says, do you think you drink too much? I guess so, he responded. And we're Baptists. Modern Baptists can drink. It's only stuffed shirts like Dr. Pflug who don't. Well, I guess I'm a modern Baptist then. People are redefining who they are and what their values are. So, it's interesting world. And one other, because it sounds like it's a Lutheran's involved here. In The Habits of the Heart by Robert Bellow, they had interviewed a young nurse whose name was Sheila Larson. That's not like a...
That's a Lutheran name.
Whom they describe as a representative of many Americans' experiences and views on religion. Speaking about her own faith and how it operates in her life, she says, I believe in God. I'm not a religious fanatic. I can't remember the last time I went to church. My faith has carried me a long way. It's a Sheilaism. That's her word. It's a Sheilaism. Just my own little voice. So her faith in God was very personal, very self-defined, very unrelated to any other Christian tradition or any other Christian vision. She was her own values. So our dilemma is we have our own values, but we want values that are encompassing and can pick up and carry people's lives, and we're struggling at it, and I don't know how we're going to get there. Martin Luther King, didn't he somehow touch in our lives points to which we responded?
He had a vision.
He had a vision, and he was able to convey that. His own people, he mobilized them around the vision. He mobilized a lot of us white people around that vision. I mean, that's this is what I'm talking about. We're not going to have one vision where we vote in Congress, right? We're talking about a vision that somehow that we can all enter into and pull out of ourselves and move ahead. And it seems to me that right now in our country, we are terribly in lack of a vision.
But Bill, don't visions arise out of a need that people agree is important and rally around? Visions don't drop down out of heaven like a cloud.
But don't we have a lot of the problems?
Yeah, and I think that's a healthy thing. They're beginning to be identified.
The people who come out and address problems are often have to have a great deal of strength and some strength and backing them, because most people don't want to believe or see problems that do exist. There's no problem here. No, there's no problem. I mean, when there is a serious problem, it's easier to cover it up that there's no problem than it is to bring it out and be powerful enough to drive to the issue with a vision that may carry you through and over the problem.
Yeah.
Because there's usually economic interests and powerful interests that would like to say, that would like to keep that problem submerged, because it's probably taking advantage of someone for someone else's benefit.
It's exploitative.
Yeah.
Exploited vision.
You've got Billy Graham.
I've got Billy Graham.
Well, I see Billy Graham is a leader with many followers.
Does he grip you?
Vision.
Does he grip you?
Not particularly.
Same here.
Yeah. I'll just say, Bill, let me say a counter word here. We don't have some tension, we won't have any growth.
That's right.
Billy has been a leader in a fine and creative way in the race program. His Little Rock stand was one of the early stands there. A number of places he made a public witness. He wouldn't hold a crusade without an interracial ushers, counselors, and choir. Mm-hmm. He did that at a time nobody else had guts to. Mm-hmm. And I sat with him in Charlotte, North Carolina on his birthday, and he said, I lost a lot of friends because of what I did. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can't have one person be a skyrocket leader in every subject,
yeah.
But in his witness, he made a contribution.
That he did. He was always too slow for me. Through the matter, he was too slow for me. And when he came to Seattle, what, about 72, 73, 74?
Yeah.
They came to me asked me if I would put my name on the line.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't like the way he dealt with the Vietnam issue. What was over, practically, he said it was a bad war. So I didn't participate in that. I had been about 5-6 years before that, I'm confessing here to you, about 5-6 years before that, we had a big rally in Portland. And I said, I'm going to cooperate this up to the hilt. And so we were fully involved in it and cooperated in it. I was on the platform, never got a chance to say anything except a little prayer. But I didn't feel after the Billy Graham crusade was over, it was back to business as usual, and nothing had happened. See? Now, I'm not saying that he's not a very sincere man and a great man and has done a wonderful lot for a lot of people. But we're talking here about the vision of America. Right? You see what I mean?
Let me respond to that. We raised $164,000 for the homeless, for hunger, at that crusade. Mm-hmm. And it was divided between the local people and the world hunger situation. And now that's the kind of thing that's just conveniently forgotten.
Yeah.
But that was a significant, right, specific contribution to the need of the community.
I just got into a bad problem in Seattle.
Yes.
Just before I retired, although there was no relationship. There was a very, very excellent, I mean, he was packing them in a church in Seattle, University Presbyterian Church. And I made the mistake of talking to a reporter, answering a question a reporter asked me. She asked me what I thought about this university church and this minister of this church. And I said, well, he tends to preach to people's own, what they want to hear. And he doesn't have a sense of justice, but he thinks more in terms of charity and witness. And she put some of that in the paper. And he got angry at me, and didn't write a letter to me. He wrote a letter to a friend, just blasting me because didn't understand that his church was very socially involved. They were feeding people on the roads and down in the Skid Row area, and they were building housing and all that kind of stuff. But I said, see, my ministry had been working for justice, for peace, for justice. I said, that is not standing for justice. You got to stand with the farm worker. You got to stand with the janitors who are not getting a decent wage. You know, that is what justice is all about. And we have a church that's too easily supported charity. When what Amos said was, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. So to me, part of the vision, if I was going to paint the vision, would be a vision of justice in America. Justice for all people. Justice for the Mexican-Americans, for the gay people, for women, for people on the farms who are being taken advantage of, and on, justice. Where the powerful are somehow kept within bounds. You know, and our society is moving toward the number of people who are the very wealthy and the poor growing greater. We have a real justice problem. We cannot take care of it through food banks. Because in Seattle, I was back in 70 when Boeing Company went down like that from 100,000 workers to 35,000 workers. I came to Seattle. I didn't come to Seattle to feed people, but I spent a couple of years helping to organize food banks and feeding people in food banks. Now, 20 years later, we're still feeding people in food banks, right? So I feel like, what?
It's worse.
It's worse. It's getting worse, not better. And so the time I spent on charity, I should have been doing something else. I mean, I shouldn't. You don't let people starve. But you have to go to the source of the problem if you can get at it.
Where is the source, Bill?
Well, the
tell
source.
Tell us about your vision and how we are to accomplish it.
Wow. Come tomorrow.
Oh, you got the answer. Good.
No, I don't have it. No, I was honest when I said to you I don't have that common vision, but I think that we have to be concerned about it and think about it, and. And I think there are people that can speak that vision. But anyway, that's kind of my.
May I say something here that has just dawned on me, and maybe from my slowness, in the group that I have, that we are struggling like this too, and I'm mentioning different things, and I've given the history of the women's movement, and. We struggle back and forth and the religious aspect of it. And I think part of our big problem is that we do not have this common vision. and we're trying to piece in together something where we can't articulate the vision.
I don't think you can have a common vision. In fact, from this book that you recommend we read, yeah. where they say that you have a public, okay, yeah. the common vision is sculpted from the many competing visions. It's not something that you can discern at any one point in time. It's something that goes with time. So and in a public situation, you always have these competing visions. And without the competing visions, then you have no vision at all, except for the individual vision.
So part of the vision is that we have a society where we can compete publicly, over what are the visions we want to use as our vision.
And I think that's the other clue. That's the other clue. We all do think there's a common vision someplace. And we try to fit ourselves or try to take what the discussion is and fit it into that common vision. And if it doesn't fit into our own particular vision or what we're going to picture in our own minds, then we struggle. You know, the denominations even have a common vision.
So
women have a vision. Well, men have a vision.
Well, exactly. I mean, each time I leave from a session like this, my vision has evolved. And by sharing and participating with everyone else in a meeting like this, I think all our visions have evolved towards something that's more common than what it had been before. Mm-hmm.
So it's important that everybody in our society have a right to equally share their vision and to fight for the vision for America, and that is a part of our vision. To show you how, I mean, we are really pretty much alike. I mean, you know, we're a lot alike. As I said, we're all middle class and moderate Protestants. But we have been organizing an interfaith council with Hindus and Baha'is and Unitarians and Mormons and Native Americans and Mohammedans, and Jews and Christians. And they only allow us to come in as Christians. We don't come in as Methodists and Catholics and all that. So one of our first meetings we held, the Swami from the Hindu tradition, the Dhamma Society, gets up and he says, "I want to say this before we begin." He says, "In this organization, we're not going to deal with politics." And I said, "What do you mean by politics?" Well, he tried to go on like that. And we had a rather lengthy discussion. And I kept pressing, "What do you mean by politics?" And what I found out was that he was talking about we weren't going to do with my politics, but we were going to do with his politics. You know what I mean? So that is part of the problem. In a dialogue, you know, I think what you may be going to say is pretty crazy. And you think I'm going to say it's crazy, but we have to talk about it, see? And come up with some common vision. But in America, what bothers me a bit, we're not getting that kind of discussion we need.
But isn't the common vision, when you get right down to it, is preservation of the human race, particularly my species?
Well, as Christians, we fill that vision in a little bit more than that, don't we? Don't we fill it in a little bit more than just survival?
Well, not really. When it comes right down to the nitty gritty, that's what we're after.
Well, don't we all believe that the basic reality of all, as Christian people, as the basic reality of all of life is God, and God is love, and that we can be reconciled one to another, right? That we love God and we love our fellows, and this means justice. We have a pretty strong vision.
That's common.
What?
That is common.
I think we all agree on that, don't we?
What that would be for the Christian?
I'm talking about Christian. Now you see, with Hindu, it would be a little different.
I have a question: is it so with the fundamentalists, or I would say fanatical Christian community? They tend to ostracize, I think, more than it comes. That's why.
Well, they have a very strong vision of what America is. In fact, I've come out of that tradition, so I know what it is pretty well.
Yes.
and I can understand it, and it has certain virtues because it at least has some conviction behind it, yeah. But it's one that is not built upon too much charity. Well, listen, we got a couple more minutes for the last great words of wisdom. Those people have not said anything. They've been waiting to give us the total truth.
But we don't end till about 7:20, do we? Or 7:25?
I thought we were 50-minute segments.
Yeah.
Well, I can stay here as long as we want to.
We've got
15
more minutes.
Well, all right, we'll talk some more. You got some more ideas about it?
May I toss out this?
Yes, Rob.
The religious community should come at whatever they do from a sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. They often use the word stewardship. Mm-hmm. And that means personal responsibility for ourselves, our family, but for the wider world. Mm-hmm. And this whole thing has been coming up. You saw it at 83 at the World Council Assembly in Vancouver.
Right.
And the vision that is unfolding within the religious community is that concern and the mutuality of responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Now add to that the old psalm phrase, from one generation to another. Mm-hmm. This means as we have been blessed by those before, we must care for those coming.
Mm-hmm. I it came to me today as I was thinking about some of these things that we receive information almost immediately from all over the world through our television set, a very impersonal media. Okay, we have a communication link. We exchange ideas with the television set, ourselves and the television. Mm-hmm. This is not a very personal or a medium which has any possibility for commonality, unless you're saying that television creates our vision.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, from the context of us trying to solve the world's problems, as opposed to some of our more local and shared vision problems, can we, as a people and a nation, you know, solve the world's problems when we have so many things that we're trying to form some kind of narrowed down common vision? I don't know. You know, I mean, if you talk to people on the trail, you feel like you're actually exchanging information. But you can just tune into the tube now. Yeah. Get the whole world online.
Well, the only problem is that the whole world is interconnected. And what happens in Saudi Arabia is very important to us here. Or what happens in other parts of the world, there is a reaction. And
but
so
stewardship to the entire world when we have so many, I mean, I understand that they're all connected, but we're talking about problems in our own area, right? Food banks here.
Sure, right.
Can we solve all the problems and then solve these two, or do we start small and work outward?
Well, what do you feel?
Do you work from the top down or from the bottom up?
Top down, you're eventually going to collapse on yourself.
The thing is that we each have our own ability to make decisions. So if we keep our own little lawn clean, then Martha does her part, and Lydia does her part, and Bill comes along to guide us, why we will have a growth going in such a way it will solve the problems.
That's my hope too, that we can solve problems if we work at it. And that's an item of faith and a part of the vision, don't you think?
Goethe wrote, if every man sweeps his own doorstep, the world would be clean.
Yeah, that's right.
The only problem is there's some guy out there getting a lot of doorsteps and run the whole show. You know, that's our problem. I mean, for me, for my years in Seattle, is that there are great economic forces in our world. And if you live near the Boeing Company, you know what, you're close to it, that pays no attention to anybody. To anybody. I mean, we have objected to apartheid and selling planes to South Africa. How do you boycott airplanes? I mean, how often do we buy an airplane, right? All we can do is kind of make them feel guilty, the president. But beyond that, so there are great economic forces that have control of our lives, and these only can be dealt with in the political realm, I think.
But you got to get inside the power structure. Do you have any people on the Boeing board? You got to get inside and shape them from within, Bill. You know that.
I gave up on that
long time. Bitch.
I gave up on that long time ago. I gave up a long time ago because I was told by an elderly woman in Seattle who knew everybody and everything, and we were complaining about the banks were not, you know, they were lending money in South Africa. And, well, she said to me, well, all you have to do is go down to the CFirst Bank and talk to Joe and tell him that he's doing the wrong thing, see? And she apparently knew everybody in town. And she believed that you could actually persuade them by moral persuasion to do the right thing. But what I have found, now I may be crazy, is that you have to use a little bit of pressure other than. And so we have to have vigils out there. We try to go in and see the president of the Boeing company, but he won't see me.
If you try to get in the way of a $120 million 747 sale, and if you're one person on the board, they'll be I'm certain.
And not that I've got anything against Boeing. Boeing is like any other big company. They're all the same. And the bottom line comes first, and they are part of the people who are really out to get what they can out of society, although they do give back money by hiring people. But yet they are very powerful and are not open to the opinions of the community. They really are not. In fact, they won't allow themselves to be incorporated into the Seattle city limits. They go down to state house and will not allow a state income tax so that the load can be spread out evenly with the wealthy paying their percentage. They won't allow it. In cahoots with Weyerhaeuser Corporation and Burlington Northern and a few groups. And so there are groups in our society that stand in kind of the way of the visions that we have for the welfare of people.
Well, even closer to home, we did have friends on the board of the University of Washington. We call that board, appointed by the governor, and when the students and people wanted them to pull their investments out of South Africa, they refused. I think there was only one vote for it, and that was a black man.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
I think also, I mean, yeah. Some of those things, it isn't just, a lot of this, it isn't just the big companies and all the people agree that they want to have a state income tax or whatever the issue is. I think, you know, if all the people felt that way, it would eventually get pushed through, but I think the people are divided on those issues, isn't it?
Well, if you spend $1 million fighting it, it helps.
And tell them, the people, that the taxes are going up. That's, you just have to use that one red flag. Your taxes are going up if you pay for children.
I mean, tell them little lies. Tell them little lies.
You got 90,000 paid voters that'll vote against it. Right, I mean, the entire...
Right in the beginning.
I think most of the Boeing employees...
Buckle in, hungry?
Well, I think most of them are sucked in. I think a lot of them lose themselves fairly quickly inside that structure anyways.
Has anybody taken the time and effort to run an environmental impact statement on as a result of pulling all of the investments out of South Africa?
No, no one has done that.
What that would do to South Africa?
Yeah. Well, the only authority that I have listened to, and I've listened to the other authority, but that I listen to is the black people that I know through the churches and through the Tutu and people like that. And they've come here and they said, we want you, we will suffer for a while, our country will suffer a while, but we want you to divest so we can get our freedom.
That's exactly what Mrs. Soldner said last night.
Did she say that?
About apartheid, and she said that's what the blacks told her.
Right.
And in the Northwest, you know, we have a lot of students over here. You can talk to
somebody from Namibia, any day of the week you want to. Just go to our colleges. There are a lot of them that have been brought over here. There's some at PLU. There's some up in the little Peninsula College in Port Angeles and from Zimbabwe. Well, and they all say the same thing.
Well, we have a, you know, we have a very strong network into the South Africa and Namibia. We really do. And Lutherans, you really have, you have the pipeline in Namibia. And so we're, and the World Council of Churches has played a very important role in this regard. They cannot, any of the people from the World Council of Churches cannot go into South Africa. They wouldn't let them in. But they've piped money in there, and they've even tried to keep that from happening. And they have created networks of people that have helped this whole process of liberation. So we can be proud of that. We can be proud of that.
Where does the money go?
Oh, well, the South African Council of Churches didn't have enough money to operate with. So they had to have money from outside just for their own operations.
Well, organizing churches and stuff like that.
Yeah, right. Oh. Well, let me
all
see.
It sounds like greed to me.
What?
It all sounds like greed.
Well,
to me.
It's pretty basic, some pretty basic human errors there. I must, if I could summarize, we have not agreed that we can have a common vision that we're all going to sign to. We do believe that we have at least a process, a democratic, open process, through which we can have competing visions, and that we Christians are in that, we're in on the competing, by the way, right? And that, so that's an important thing. And the important thing is to understand that God is the Lord of this universe, and that, you know, that we are God's people, and that we know we have a pretty clear idea ourselves, the kind of world we want. I mean, the Bible is filled with it, and we pray it here every day. That's the vision, but it's a competing vision. It competes with greed. Okay.
The trouble with some of our churches, this is by the pastor from, one of the pastors from PLU, he went to this seminar and he thought, oh, another evangelist. I'll go to sleep through all of this. And the first thing the evangelist said was wrong with our churches today, we don't believe in God.
All right.
That's something to think about.
I have about 5 copies of this marvelous sermon that I quoted from.
Did you have a connection?